Hi there. I'm Tim Fernholz with Good Magazine in Los Angeles, and I am joined today by Kevin Williamson of National Review, and we're going to talk about the economic chaos that is engulfing our country and the world. So it'll be a fun one, and we want to start off with the S&P downgrade of U.S. sovereign debt that happened on Friday night, sort of kicked off the latest round of madness. Kevin, I guess the big question is, and I think I know what your answer is going to be, was S&P right? And are the other two bond rating agencies, Moody and Fitch, who still have us at AAA wrong?
Well, guys, actually, maybe my answer is a little less predictable on that than you think. I think everybody probably should have downgraded a long time ago. Now, if you want to say that S&P has judged that the U.S. is AA+, but France is AAA, and Germany is AAA, and some other places are that have significantly weaker finances, I would agree with you on that, that if those countries are AAA, we certainly should be. But in terms of a directional indicator of where our finances are headed, particularly where our debts and deficits are headed, I think it's a useful and productive wake-up call. I think one of the things that always needs to be emphasized is that the credit rating agencies are not there to tell us things that we don't already know. You know, the markets, investors, people who pay attention to this stuff have made their own decisions a long time ago. The role of the credit rating agencies, particularly these 10 federally recognized ones that have a particular standing under law, is basically to certify conventional wisdom coming out of the marketplace. You know, people have already made their decision about the future of the dollar.
That's the question, right? Because Treasuries rallied on Monday when the stock market just plummeted.
Right, yeah, and you know, money's going to be looking for safe havens. And again, investors don't go, oh, well, Moody's says this and S&P says that, and therefore I'm going to move my money that way. They don't do that. The role of the credit rating agencies is to come in after the fact and sort of formalize decisions that have already been made before it's ever gotten to them. So, you know, the real downgrade came months ago, and it's been visible, I think, in the decline of the dollar versus gold. It's been visible in the overall weakness of our currency and some other transactions. I think that's where you really see the real economic data on that.
But, you know, that's interesting. So you're saying we shouldn't be looking at interest rates to figure out, like, what the markets think about our sovereign debt. We should be looking at the value of the dollar.
Well, I think the value of the dollar is one thing to look at. Interest rates
Because the thing that has always boggled my mind, not just in the past 6 months, has been interest rates. You know, because since 2008, even, people have been saying, get ready for the inflation spike, get ready for the interest rate spike, and we haven't seen it. And I really thought in the, like, 6 months of debt ceiling negotiations, that seemed to me like that was the time we would have the interest rate spike, we would have actual downgrades. You know, it was the timing of the S&P's decision after a deal that admittedly was sort of a punt deal.
Well, there's a pretty good and obvious explanation for why there hasn't been an interest rate spike in government bonds, whether in the United States or in Europe, and that's because the largest player in the marketplace is a non-economic investor. It's the Federal Reserve in the United States and the ECB in Europe. Because the Fed is not a normal investor, because it doesn't have normal economic incentives, it's not out there trying to look for a higher return on the bonds that it's buying. And, of course, it's buying the majority of the bonds being issued by the federal government, at least it has over the last couple of years. Same thing with the European Central Bank. It is undertaking a particular discrete strategy to keep interest rates down. So when your biggest player in the marketplace is a non-economic player that's pursuing a political agenda rather than a financial agenda, it's no surprise that you haven't seen interest rates go up. Simply, there's not another single investor in the marketplace that can outweigh what the Fed is doing. Now, that may not be the case forever if the entire marketplace turns against it, but for now, the Fed certainly has the power to keep those rates down, being the biggest player in the market. That may change in a few months. I wouldn't be surprised if it did. But the other thing, of course, it's not just Fed policy. We're always very lucky in the last couple of years that no matter how irresponsible and incontinent our friends in Washington are, they're not as bad as the guys in Brussels and Rome and some other places. So the European chaos in the European contagion has, I think, functioned as a de facto subsidy of American debt. And this is where the credit rating agencies get it wrong. The markets still think that U.S. treasuries are the safest place to park money, at least in the short to medium term. And they're probably right about that.
So here's my question. What is the political reaction going to be in Washington to this? I mean, people are saying, I think an S&P probably hopes that this was sort of like a wake-up call. Maybe everybody will actually start doing something more productive than the deal we saw 2 weeks ago. But it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. Do you think it will? I mean, have you seen this memo that Eric Cantor has sent to his Republican colleagues in the House?
Short term, no one can say. I mean, short politics, like markets, you know, in the short term, run off of emotions, greed, panic, fear, all the rest of it. In the long term, I think I have a pretty good idea of what the policy changes will look like. I think I've had a pretty good idea about that for a while, which is that you're going to get entitlement reform, probably along the lines visualized by Paul Ryan and people of that cut, and you're going to get higher taxes. I mean, those are the two things that are almost inevitable, and that's not really because of political energies. It's just the math. That's how you have to do it to make the numbers work out without having, you know, really radical changes in the structure of the American polity. So if you're going to have a United States that 20 years from now looks familiar to people, that looks something like what the United States looks like now, then the only way you get there without going through bankruptcy, actual default, some sort of radical restructuring, is through entitlement reform and probably higher taxes.
So I think you're right. Maybe not so much about the specifics of the Paul Ryan plan, which is interesting, but I think, yeah, you do see that, you know, there's going to be entitlement reform, and not the kind that I think Democrats would like, but you're going to see entitlement reform with benefit cuts. But, you know, that requires the grand bargain, right? That requires, because certainly Republicans are not excited about higher taxes and never have been, and Democrats aren't going to want to support entitlement reform without some kind of balancing effect, as they like to call it. So where does that come from? And I want to reference, because I actually really liked this, which is rare for me, I'm not a huge fan, this column in the New York Times by Ross Douthat the other day about how parties are always waiting, you know, for their realignment election, and they think they're going to get an election where they get everything they want, where in fact, you know, that doesn't really happen very much, and when it does, it sort of turns out to be a disaster for the party in question that thinks it got what it wanted. When I was back in Washington, I recently was in Washington covering the debt ceiling debate for a long time, and what a lot of the people in the 90s, I would talk to, like, Newt Gingrich's old negotiators from the 96 budget deal or what have you, and they would always say that it took the 96 election, when voters confirmed divided government, to really get the two parties to focus on things. You know, after 94, when the Republicans came back, both, I think, the White House and Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich and his team in the House basically thought that they would just win the next election. And I think both parties now have sort of the same idea, that they're just going to win the next election and then they'll get what they want. But I'm not sure that's true. And I'm curious, do you see any chance of there being a deal of any sort of reasonable magnitude or balance or compromise before the next election?
No, I don't think before the next election. That seems unlikely. There'll be some piecemeal stuff and some muddle through stuff. I hate to predict the outcomes of elections, obviously, because if I were good at that, I would make a lot of money consulting. But also because American voters are irrational and ignorant and they're unpredictable, so it's hard to say what they do or why they make certain decisions.
They're a lovely bunch of people.
Well, they are a lovely bunch of people, and, you know, I like my neighbors as much as the next guy, but, you know, you're talking about asking people to understand a large set of complex questions that even the experts in those fields maybe only have one piece of. You know, there's no American voter, even the smartest guy in the country, who is an expert with deep knowledge on Afghanistan, Iraq, bond futures, credit rating, you know, real estate derivatives, and all the rest of the stuff the government touches. There's no one in government, there's no voter, there's no one else who actually knows that stuff. So you get a great deal of randomness and irrationality in the political process. That's just a feature of democracy. I think that when you start to get a grand bargain, when you start to get people acting the way that they probably need to over the long term, will not come from political pressure, but it'll come from financial pressure, either when interest rates start to go up significantly on treasuries, which I expect that they will, although I would not hazard a guess over what time frame that'll be, or when you see something like the U.S. government having a bond auction and the bond's not clearing, you know, that they don't sell out. And when that happens, of course, interest rates will have to go up, or they'll have to start selling fewer bonds. Or you'll see things like foreign central banks, particularly the Chinese and the Japanese and some others, start to liquidate their dollar and treasury holdings. And those things will put enough pressure on public finances that there will be fewer and fewer alternatives. You know, one of the things I like about the Fed meeting today that's going on is they keep saying, well, we're out of alternatives, we're out of ideas, we're out of quivers in our bow, or arrows in our quiver, rather. And of course they are, because, A, the ideas that they've been pursuing so far don't work.
Let me take issue with that for just a minute, because I think there's a lot the Fed can do.
Well, okay, maybe you think that, but the Fed is out there saying, well, there's not much we can do right now. You know, that we can do another round of quantitative easing. We can maybe, do this or that. But there's this sort of rhetoric accompanying them right now that they are running out of options. And I think they're right about that. But you don't, so go ahead.
No. Well, let me take a trip back to the 2002 era of Ben Bernanke and his, Fed research, where he was, writing about Japan and invoking also Milton Friedman, and talking about what happens when you hit that lower bound of interest rates and what the Fed can do. And you're right, quantitative easing 2 happened, QE2, and that provided a boost. And I think actually a lot of the S&P loss that we've seen in the last couple weeks, the sort of the bear market it looks like we're going into, has actually had more to do with the withdrawal of QE2 and the low growth that we're sort of expecting now than anything to do with the sovereign situation. But what the Fed could do, and what I would like to see it do, is get ready for some inflation and just say, look, we're going to, one, set an inflation target of 4%. Kenneth Rogoff thinks it should be 6%, the economist who's been writing a lot about these debt issues recently, and that they are going to, pursue quantitative easing policies until the unemployment rate drops. And when you get those inflation expectations high, you give businesses an incentive to invest that they don't have right now. I'm curious, the major economic problem that I see in this country is growth. We're not growing fast enough to replace jobs, to fill up our capacity, to get debt going away by increasing tax revenues. Liberals like to point out that we have the lowest tax revenue right now since 1952, and conservatives like to point out that's because the economy is so crappy. So the way to solve that, at least in part, is through growth. And, I think the Fed could do a lot more to use the powers that it has to control inflation expectations to get people to do that. And it's been disappointing to me, and I think a lot of people, and not even just, liberals and progressives, but also folks like Ramesh Banuru and Scott Sumner, who have looked at the Fed and sort of seen it throwing up its hands when it seems to have at least some options to work with markets and get things going.
Yeah, when I hear the word growth, what I hear in my head is the word magic. Growth is the magic formula that keeps us from having to make hard decisions. A lot of my, sort of naive supply-side friends, some of the Eric Cantors of the world, and Tim Pawlenty is particularly guilty of this, will come out and say, well, gosh, if we just have 5.5% growth, then all of our problems are solved. And, of course, that's unlikely. And if the Fed or anyone else in government knew how to actually cause real growth, of course they'd be doing it. But the truth is they don't. And I think that there's a lot of misdiagnosis of our current proposition. Let me finish this real quick, because I think this will speak to where we're going with the conversation, which is that even if this sort of Keynesian demand management school of thought has a place, which I don't think that it does, but even if it did, what we're dealing with right now isn't a normal business cycle recession. It's something that has to do with a very large balance sheet event, which was that up through 2007, 2008, there were a lot of people who thought they had $400,000 in equity in their house or $500,000 in equity in their house, and they figured out that they only have $250,000 or $300,000 or something significantly less than they did. They had made all sorts of plans, these American people, about how to work, where to work, what to save in, when to retire, how to invest, those sorts of things, based on faulty assumptions about their wealth, about how much equity they had in their homes. when that $7 trillion or whatever disappeared, all of those plans had to, of course, unravel because they were based on an economic reality that was not going to come to pass. It was a fiction. And all of the businesses that had made decisions about how to serve those customers, selling them condos in Florida and cruises and new cars and all the rest of the stuff, also have figured out that they made investments in the wrong places, in the wrong lines of business, under a model that's not actually sustainable under what people's real wealth is. Now, you can have the Fed print money, you can engage in fiscal shenanigans and attempts at stimulus and all that, but that's not going to undo what's actually happened to people's household wealth. All you can really do is wait for those positions to unwind themselves and capital to go into actual fruitful enterprises. And that's the real break on growth right now. You know, our growth situation is not entirely dependent on policy. You know, policy is an aspect of it, but it's not the dominant aspect of it.
You're absolutely right. And let me try and elaborate on your story. So you're talking about this sort of great deleveraging, great contraction sort of issue, which I think is the right way to understand this recession, is people have a lot more household debt suddenly than they thought. People have a lot more corporate debt, and countries have a lot more debt. And if you can't begin investing and growing again until you lessen that debt load. And the real debate right now, I think, even if we're not always admitting it, is who is going to take the hit on all that debt that's not going to get paid. And, you know, creditors would like it to be their debtors, and debtors would like it to not be them. But regardless, it's not going to change until we deal with that. And that's why I think a lot of people are looking to old-fashioned inflation as the way to deal with this in sort of the most painless and efficient way possible.
But inflation is just another way to destroy wealth.
The way to speed up this deleveraging is through that. And talking about Europe and the sovereign debt situation there, I think we keep seeing the ECB go back to this, you know, we're going to buy more debt or we're going to impose austerity policies. And what it reminds me of is, I don't know if you've, you know, followed, I didn't at the time, I was probably nine, I was older than that, but the financial sovereign debt crisis at the end of the 90s, Paul Bluestein wrote a really good book called The Chastening about that experience, and you saw financial contagion spread from Korea to Indonesia to Thailand to all of these countries around the world to Brazil. And each time they sort of tried to bail out these countries, and it didn't work, and it didn't work until they started doing bail-ins. And they got creditors to sit down and take a haircut and say, look, you know, we're not going to get past this and move again until we take responsibility on both sides of the balance sheet. And so I think, you know, in terms of what policymakers should be doing, they should recognize your analysis of what's happening, but I think they should be a little more proactive about what they can do to speed along the deleveraging, because, you know, it's not helping anybody to see the United States sit at, you know,
right. But where you're wrong there is it's not just a question of deleveraging. It's not just a question of household debt, but vanished household wealth. There's a lot of households that have a positive balance sheet that have, you know, net worth and not a negative net worth. Still have had to have their economic plans disrupted because they have less wealth than they thought they did, even though they may not be in net debt. So you can't really solve that problem by forcing a haircut on, say, mortgage creditors. Now, there may be good reasons to do that, and personally, I think we just ought to let housing prices fall, let the mortgage market do what it's going to do, at which point a lot of creditors are probably going to enter into more voluntary negotiations than they have in the past because they want to recover something rather than lose things entirely. You know, there is a bottom under housing. I mean, housing still has an inherent net worth. It's not going to go to zero. So there's no need to worry, I think, about that. But in terms of coming in and imposing some sort of inflationary policy, which is just another way to destroy household wealth, you know, such household wealth as still exists is going to be eaten up at a rate of 4 or 5% a year if you pursue a policy of intentional inflation. So I don't see how that makes the country better off by actually impoverishing people. You know, there's this sort of idea, and this is, you know, guys on your side are particularly guilty of, although there's a lot of guys on the right that are guilty of it too, that Washington is actually intellectually capable of imposing this sort of grand management scheme on something as complex as the global economy, and it's not. And if you go out looking for inflation intentionally, you know, you end up finding it in ways that you didn't mean to. If you look at the story of the housing bubble, that's a story of inflation. Now, it's very concentrated inflation. It's not general consumer price inflation. It's inflation of a particular class of assets, of real estate. We've seen the same thing happen with certain commodities in the last couple of years. Some people would argue that the recent boom in stocks over the last 2 years was essentially a form of equities inflation, people not wanting to hold on to dollars because the Fed is in a long-term program of devaluing the dollar. So you never know where that's going to go. You know, you hope for this sort of even, orderly kind of general rise in consumer prices that will produce the kind of political outcomes you think you want, but you never know what's actually going to happen. You may just be inflating another bubble. And Washington's record for macroeconomic management over the last 20 years under either party is not especially good, so I'm not sure I'd want to follow you down that road.
Well, I will say, I mean, the thing to note on just inflation is the record on keeping inflation low since Mr. Volcker ended the recession in the early 80s has been quite good and getting better, and we've gone to a lot of trouble to establish the credibility that low inflation is something we could do and have done. And you know, people for the last 3 or 4 years, again, and this is sort of what is always boggling to me, have been saying, the big inflation is coming, the big inflation is coming, we got to be ready, we need to start tightening, and it hasn't happened. And it's one of those cases where the prescription is always the same, no matter the conditions, and that gets me to wondering, you know, whether there is a lot of actual thought about the tools available, or whether we're sort of living in a world where we're so worried about the problem that's 5 or 10 years down the line that we're not fixing the problems we have right now.
Yeah, I think those are the words of a young man, Tim, you know, saying, well, it hasn't happened since, you know, the first Reagan administration. Therefore, you know, that's the end of history, really, or the beginning of it. You know, our problems with inflation go back longer than that. And I think that you probably don't remember it, but you may not have even been born then. But the recession that was necessary to squeeze that inflation out of the economy that was pursued by Mr. Volcker and by the Reagan administration was extraordinarily disruptive and painful. It's not the sort of thing you want to go through again.
Is it worse than now?
Oh no, I don't think so. Probably, but you could certainly inflict inflation of those levels on an economy that looks like this one does now and make things that much worse, and then have to inflict additional policies on top of it to get that inflation in check. So, you know, the idea that inflation is going to get economically and politically done what you want to get done is not well established. In fact, it's kind of a cheap shortcut in my view. Because inflation doesn't create wealth, inflation destroys wealth.
Well, it also destroys debt. And if debt is our problem, and I mean, I guess we disagree. And I guess just my question is this: you know, we have been in a pretty serious crisis for a pretty long time now. At what point do we have to get beyond the conventional wisdom, or what's always been done, or just letting it happen?
Well, it depends on whose conventional wisdom you're talking about, I guess. You know, the sort of neo-Keynesian approach that we've seen from the Obama administration has, I think, proven itself inadequate to the task. I think that if you're agreeing with me that our real problem long-term is growth and productivity, then you take different policies that encourage growth and productivity. By the way, inflation is not one of those policies, because inflation is just wealth transfer from creditors to debtors, and that's not necessarily a healthy thing, especially when the biggest debtor in the world is Uncle Sam, who spends the money on all sorts of ridiculous things that don't actually create any net good for the world. So, yeah, and if you can show me something that the Obama administration has done in the last few years that actually is a positive step toward encouraging long-term capital investment in the American economy, which is where growth and jobs and employment and tax revenue and all the rest of that good stuff comes from, well, then I'd be very pleased to hear about it.
Well, you know, I would say, well, you know, there's two things. I mean, one is the stimulus for all of its badness and goodness and whatever you want to say about it did have components that are dedicated towards ensuring long-term investment.
Really? Let's hear about one. I'd like to hear how setting $1 trillion on fire has encouraged long-term investment in the American economy.
Well, you know, there's a company called Alcoa. It's a big aluminum firm. They spent stimulus money to build a new factory. It's been pretty productive for them and hired back a lot of workers, and that's the sort of infrastructure investment you want to see. It's stimulus invested in rural broadband infrastructure to help bring
yes,
the internet to broader regions of the country, which is, I think, an important way to develop innovation and bring more people into the modern economy. I think it invested in, you know, basic stuff.
Now Tim, you know better than to tell me that a factory which is only productive when it's receiving subsidies of a sort from the federal government is actually a legitimate long-term economic investment. It's not.
I think that it will be. I mean, look, if it's only productive while it's receiving subsidies, obviously it won't, but the stimulus ended 6 months ago or a year ago, and it's still going. So maybe it's the idea that you prime the pump, that when you get that initial investment, it pays off over time. And, you know, a lot of the better ideas for long-term investment were left out of the stimulus because people, frankly, didn't want them in Congress. And that's an old rehashed debate. But look at now. Like, the president is supportive of a national infrastructure bank. Reihan Salam wrote an op-ed about how we need to invest more in infrastructure now. I think that's something that everybody agrees, that long-term infrastructure investment is a good way to promote long-term growth. And there are political reasons why that's not going to happen.
I don't think everyone agrees with that.
I'm sorry?
I don't think everyone agrees with that. I certainly don't. But that's another issue. But I think if you will look at, you know, the example of, say, you know, Spain thought it was going to create this great green energy industry, and it worked for a while. And they had all sorts of stimulus money that was pushed into that energy, and all sorts of jobs were created, and factories, and, you know, solar power plants and things like that. And then, of course, the money stopped because Spain spent itself into a hole, and that industry collapsed.
Basically, overnight.
Sure,
I'm not talking about industrial policy. I mean,
well, you were talking about Alcoa, I think, is an industrial concern, is it not?
Oh, sure. But my point there was just that there have been, but I don't think that grant that they received was targeted at Alcoa.
So anyway, why would a guy on the left like you want to subsidize these, you know, Fortune 500 fat cats over at Alcoa? What's the story there?
I want to subsidize anybody that will create jobs.
Oh, really?
That's not true.
But you're not
talking about infrastructure investments. You're not talking about broadband. You're not talking about smart grid. You're not talking about giving businesses the tools that they need to make stuff happen.
You're goddamn right. I'm not talking about rural broadband and smart grid. I mean, those are boondoggles on top of boondoggles. But
well, what's your prescription? How do you invest for long-term growth? Do you not? I mean,
governments don't invest.
Highway systems seem
governments
to have
don't invest. Governments
back in the 50s.
Government's job is to protect property and enforce contracts. That's what it's there to do. Governments cannot manage economies. They don't have a good track record of doing it. Most of what they do is inherently.
The last 60 years of American history has a few counterexamples to that.
No, I don't think so. You know,
who was it that invented the internet that, you know, brought such a big productivity boom to the United States? It wasn't Al Gore, but it was.
No, that's not to say that there's not a way to commercialize government R&D. Of course there is. I mean, you know. A wristwatch is, you know, a former item of military usage. There's all sorts of things governments do. You know, there wouldn't be a Colt company if it weren't for government contracts, right? I'm not saying governments and their research and development, their purchases, can't have a positive impact on the economy. That's a different thing from saying the government is there to manage the economy.
I'm not saying, you know, I think those are two different conversations. I mean, I do think the government plays a role in managing the conversation, but right now we're just talking about investments and how we can, like, lay the foundation for long-term
growth. Right, but see, even in the case of the Internet, you're talking about two very different things. You had the government investing in a communications network for itself, for its own purposes, mostly for military purposes, and that's fine. Maybe that's the government, you know, doing what government does, managing government affairs. What happened from there with the invention of the World Wide Web and all the rest of it was not a government project. It was not, you know, government plan, government manage, a government investment of any sort. And it was just simply the commercialization of a piece of technology that was developed for a military application, which is not the same thing as saying we're going to have government investing in the economy, because governments, of course, invest in the military. That's part of what they're there to do.
But what about infrastructure investments? What about, you know, starting with the Erie Canal and heading up forward?
Well, let's say government infrastructure
economic benefits.
For instance, under the Eisenhower administration, we began to develop this vast network of federal highways, which basically replicated a freight system that was much more efficient and run by rail. It turned out to be an enormous subsidy for urban sprawl and suburban sprawl. It was the greatest gift ever given to white flight. It has hollowed out the inner cities. It cost $1 trillion a year to maintain. Everyone thought it was a great idea at the time. People still think it's a great idea to have a federally managed interstate highway system for whatever reason. But no one ever actually takes account of the real costs of it and what the alternatives to it were. So is this a more sensible and reasonable way of moving freight and people around the country than the rail system that persisted before it? I don't think so. I don't see any really good evidence of it. People who talk about, well, gosh, we're all dependent on foreign oil and such things. Well, that's part of the reason for that is because we made a conscious decision to have a system of moving people and freight based on highways and trucks rather than trains and other modes of transport. So, yeah, I mean, it's probably the biggest infrastructure project in our national history, at least in the modern era. I think that it's probably been a net loss, and I don't see any reason to suspect the government will do a better job on other projects.
All right. Well, I don't think we're going to see eye to eye here. So let me ask you a related but different question. Mm. So I just came out here to LA to work for this magazine called Good, and I'm heading up this thing called the Good Company Project, where we're going to go out and sort of do like a Fortune 500 list, except it's 40 mid-sized companies who are innovative and profitable and sustainable and doing things the right way. And we're asking everybody what makes a good company. So I'm curious, you know, Kevin, what do you think makes a good company that, you know, is going to be the kind of company that's going to be in the private sector and be successful in growing and creating jobs in, you know, the next century?
Profit.
That's it? That's all you need?
Yeah. Profit's the measure of social good you do. People give you money because you create things that people actually care about. You know, people talk about profit as I would say... as though it's a subtraction from the net benefit from the overall social wealth, but it's not. In fact, it's a measure of how companies go about creating social good. The reason why ExxonMobil is wildly profitable, although its profit margins are very small, its volume is very high, is because people actually value petroleum, as it turns out. The reason why some other kinds of trendy and socially popular and politically correct industries don't flourish the way things like oil companies do or steel companies or wicked evil software companies like Microsoft, is because it turns out people, when they have to vote with their own money, don't actually value those things that highly.
Well, I don't necessarily think any of those companies are not valued or not trendy or whatever, but here's my question, you know, do you think there has to be any other concern besides profit, because those companies get away with a lot of uncost externalities, things that aren't, you know, that they're not responsible for right now, and they make a lot of profit, but they have a lot of costs for us down the road.
Sure, externalities are a real question. There are ways to deal with those. I mean, you have a tort system, for one, which is probably the main tool we should be using to deal with externalities of this sort. But sometimes you actually need, you know, a public policy to deal with certain things, like, you know, air pollution is probably a pretty good example of that. But there are very straightforward ways to deal with those sorts of issues as well. Now, do I think that a panel of do-gooders organized by Tim Fernholz is going to be able to tell what companies in lots of different industries...
It's not even a panel. It's largely just me.
Yeah. Okay. If I think just you then has sufficient knowledge to make those sorts of calls and decisions, call me skeptical, although you're a bright guy.
Well, be happy that I'm not out there just picking sectors for industrial policy and government investment. I'm just trying to find people who are sort of at the top of their game, who are doing a good job. And profitability is, you know, definitely a main criteria of what we're doing, because if you're not profitable, you're not going to be a business for very long. But, you know, I'm just curious, especially in this age where we're talking about corporations as people, we have the Citizens United decision where they have those same rights. Should they have the same expectations that we have of people operating in the world?
I'm not sure what you mean by that, Tim.
So there's this idea now. Well, what's interesting, I've been reading this book. It's a history of the early American Republic, and it talks for a little bit about, it's called Empire of Liberty. It's I think it's the Oxford University Press history. And it talks a little bit about how corporations sort of evolved at the beginning part of this country. You know, back in the days of mercantilism, when the United States was first colonized by Great Britain, you know, there weren't very many corporations, and what corporations there were like chartered by the state, generally for semi-public purposes. You know, you had companies that were like land companies, et cetera, et cetera. And then in the United States, you know, building on Adam Smith, we got this idea that, hey, we should have a lot more corporations to compete with each other. They should, you know, be doing different things. They shouldn't really be connected to the government. And that system was created where you charter your corporation and it becomes, you know, a corporate entity and you go do those things and you have competition. And it's been great for the U.S. economy. It's been the driving factor of our capitalist system, which is awesome. Don't get me wrong, but it feels like we sort of forget that corporations started as a very different thing, and there's still some sense now as corporations are saying, look, you know, we should be in like the political realm treated like people, so we should have free speech, we should have unlimited donating abilities to political campaigns. You know, if we are starting to think of corporations as sort of, you know, more than just a collection of private interests, should we be expecting more from them than just their own private interests?
Well, in terms of the free speech issues, I've never understood why one person can have free speech but two people acting in association shouldn't, or three people or 10 people or 1,000 people or however many you want. You know, I definitely would not trust you or anybody else to be making decisions about what entities and people deserve the right of free speech and which ones don't. I think that's just a, you know, fundamental bedrock liberty issue that everybody gets it, whether you're an individual, a union, a corporation, or anything else. So, yeah, I would disagree with you fundamentally on that. I think that the idea that, there's a funny thing about the word corporation, you know. I blame science fiction for this, by the way. People have a funny idea that corporations are these sort of, you know, malefactors, these kind of, these actors in the world that are extraordinarily powerful and that they have sort of obscure or shadowy interest in this sort of thing. All a corporation is a group of people deciding to cooperate together economically for some particular end, whether it's building cars or investing in stocks or running a bank or anything else. A corporation is its shareholders acting corporately.
Now, you're familiar with the realities of modern shareholder governance. Do you really think that a corporation is really controlled by, you know, me who owns, you know, $5 of Microsoft's stock?
Not as much as it is by the guy who owns $5 million, no. But that's a proportional representation. That's the way they work that way. By $5 in Microsoft stock wouldn't be a very big investment, by the way.
I'm sure Microsoft stock is probably way more than $5. That's
yeah,
just really
yeah.
An example. But my point is, and I think I'm not the only one who makes this point, is even if you own 45% of Microsoft stock, you know, you don't always have a say.
If you own 45% of the shares in any company, you've got a pretty good say on what's going to go on there. Now, some companies have better corporate governance than others. True. Companies that have bad corporate government, that's a problem for their shareholders, not for you or for anybody else on the outside.
Now, what if their bad corporate governance is resulting in some of these externalities that are hurting people or having a negative effect on society?
Well, sure. If someone's committed a tort, you sue them. If they've broken the law, you prosecute them. That's simple enough.
Okay, but let's take the tort example. How often do you think, you know, a case where it's one person who's been injured against a major corporation is actually going to be successful?
Ask McDonald's. You know, ask Pfizer, which, as I understand it, gets something like 300 new lawsuits a day coming in. You know, the tort industry is very, very healthy. These lawyers with their ads in the back of the phone book and the billboards don't need any help from you or from the government, from anybody else. They've got their business model worked out there. Maybe on net they're good for society, maybe not. But they're certainly not lacking in ambition or appetite.
Well, no, that's true. Everyone has a lot of ambition in the world. Well, all right. I admire your confidence in your ability to assess the net social benefit of everyone. I just feel like it's a more complex world than perhaps we sometimes give it credit for.
Well, right, but if you really believe that, you wouldn't be engaged in trying to plan it, because you understand that the world is more complex than you can plan for, or than the people you like politically can plan for either. Whereas I don't want to plan for anything except what I'm having for lunch today.
How's that working out for you in the long term?
Good.
Yeah, I like to look down the road a little bit more. Anything else in the business and economics world we should discuss before we get into the fun meat of the politics?
I think I'm done with that one for now.
All right. Well, so politics today, we wanted to talk about two things. And the first is Texas Governor Rick Perry, who is looks like he's about to leap into the Republican presidential race with 2 feet. And he had a big prayer rally this past weekend, and he's going to give a speech on Saturday, which all of the leaks and reports tell us he's, in a hilarious Washington term, going to make clear his intentions to run for president. But he's not actually, I think, going to announce his run for president because he'd like to get in the news again next week when he really does that.
All right.
What do you think of Rick Perry, Kevin?
Well, you know, I'm from Texas, and I think of Rick Perry as my governor, even though I live in New York. Rick Perry has as good a record as a governor as any governor I can think of in the last 20 years, probably, certainly of any governor of Texas. In a year in which everyone's main concern is going to be jobs, it's going to be hard to beat Rick Perry on that front because Texas has just a really flabbergasting record in the last 10 years for job creation and employment. He's got a very different model of government than Barack Obama does. It would be a very clear choice between two very, very different philosophies. Perry is culturally the sort of person that drives people like you crazy. You know, he prays in public, talks about Jesus, and carries a gun. That's going to drive a certain class of American
nuts. It's not going to drive me crazy.
It's going to drive a certain class of American nuts, and which is fine with me. I see those people driven nuts. You know, Perry has politically some baggage. I don't think he's a shoo-in candidate, even though I like him very much. If I could appoint him president, I might think about doing that. But, you know, he's going to be he will have a tough road against Barack Obama, as indeed I think anybody would. But I think he would probably in some ways have a tougher road than a more establishmentarian establishment candidate like, say, Mitt Romney or someone like that. But Perry is the guy who can straddle the two main worlds of the Republican Party, which is the kind of GOP establishment and the populist conservative Tea Party sort of element. He's got a foot planted firmly in both worlds, and I think more than anybody else, he can bring them together. So he's a formidable guy. People who have run against him and who have worked with him say he is one of the best campaigners they've ever seen. Most people think he's a significantly better campaigner than George W. Bush was. And, you know, ask Kay Bailey Hutchison how that worked out for her.
Didn't work out very well. I guess, so here's, just talking about Rick Perry, I mean, one thing about, you know, I'm curious, how you think of his economic management. He's benefited from a few lucky trends in Texas, which is that immigration really benefited him. Even the illegal kind helped bolster the Texas economy. Enormous sectoral boom in oil production, and the housing market never really dropped out in Texas, in part because of all that immigration and oil. And I'm curious, you know,
how can he take
credit for that, and how can he replicate that on a national level?
Yeah, I think actually you misunderstand the housing market in Texas. And here's where you'll hear me making an unusual argument for regulation. Because Texas had, you know, this horrible downturn in the 80s after the S&L crisis and the collapse of the energy markets. It has its own separate set of banking regulations. And in Texas, it was basically impossible to get a mortgage without putting 20% down. And when people have that much equity, they don't get upside down on their mortgages. You don't get a real estate bubble the way you got in the rest of the country. And so you don't get a crash afterwards. So if you're going to have regulations on things like that, you want regulations of the sort that Texas has, which are very straightforward, very easy to understand, uniformly applied, not gamed very much for political motives, saying, well, we need more credit for this class of people but less credit for that class of people for political reasons. They just basically said, look, if you don't have 20% down, it's going to be damn near impossible for you to get a mortgage, and therefore no boom, no bust. It was a nice set of rules. Now, people have said, well, Perry's benefited from all the people moving to Texas, so that's created a great economic boom, but it's a chicken and egg question. You know, why are people moving there? I mean, Texas is nice. It's a nice place to live. But people are moving there because there are jobs there. And there are jobs there because Texas has a sort of environment that is friendly toward investment. You know, Texas...
A lot of oil under the ground.
Well, no, it's not just oil. Texas has more manufacturing job growth than the rest of the country, even outside of the petroleum business, which is sometimes counted as manufacturing. Texas is now home to more Fortune 500 company headquarters than New York is. And they're not all oil firms. Some of them are banks, some of them are software companies. Technology firms, Dell, people like that, AMD, some other folks. So it's got a lot going on besides the energy sector. If you look at the actual trends of growth in Texas, it's been uniform across all sectors. Certainly energy has been very strong. Well, it's more gas, really, than oil these days. But it's not the dominant factor people make it out to be. In Texas, you know, it doesn't have a state income tax, which makes it very attractive. It's got a very flexible regulatory environment, which I think is something that ought to be looked at as a national model. You know, Texas has made enormous strides on things like air pollution, water pollution, certain sorts of toxins, things like that in the last 10, 20 years, reduced their levels, you know, by 50, 60, 70, 90% or more in some cases. But it's got a very flexible regime for doing that. You know, it's got a licensing and permitting system that actually works with businesses instead of being entirely adversarial toward them. So you still get the results that you want, but you get it without driving businesses out of your state. Tort reform has been enormously important. That was a project begun by Republicans in Texas in the middle 90s, but really came to fruition under Perry's administration. Now, I don't want to credit the governor with everything that's happened in Texas, obviously, or even the legislature or the political class, because I think there are other things going on in the state that are more important than that. But certainly to the extent that policy has been a factor, Perry deserves credit for pursuing the right ones. He made a lot of really, really tough decisions about balancing the budget the last time around, but he got it done, and he got it done in a way that's certainly going to be painful to a lot of folks in the state, but it's not going to be as disruptive as other programs might have been. So, yeah, I think he's got a real record to talk about, and I think that when you're talking about it with Barack Obama, it looks that much better.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if he makes it up to that level. Well, I want to ask you, because we originally asserted we had really wanted to talk about the prayer rally this past weekend. Now, you know, you said it would bother me that he prays in public, but it doesn't, because I'm a good believing Catholic. Mm. But my question is, you know, one, you know, is it seemly for, you know, a governor to come out and host this as a governor with a bunch of other governors? Because my question is that, you know, is that like an appropriate thing to do? And the other thing that bothers me about it more than anything
else. Wait a minute, does it bother you or does it not bother you? You just said it didn't bother you. Now you're saying it does bother you.
It doesn't bother me that he's a praying man. I think he should pray. But I just wonder how many people would react, people who aren't evangelical Christians, people who aren't even Christian, would react to someone saying what we need to do is, you know, pray for these economic problems. Because as a Christian, you know, one thing that I think, you know, is expected is you solve these problems yourself, not just through prayer. I mean, it's one of those, the old joke about the guy on the roof in the flood when the canoe goes by and he says, no, I'm going to keep praying.
Right.
You know, what are you doing about it?
But I think the difference is Perry's got more canoes than anybody else in the country right now. If you look at the job growth, if you look at Texas's economic performance, it's not as though he's just saying, well, let the chips fall where they may and maybe Jesus will start a startup in Texas. That's not been his approach. Not in the least. So you think that it's okay that he prays, but you wish he wouldn't do it in public, or you wish he wouldn't do it with other governors?
No, I wish that he wouldn't imply that that's the solution to our problems, because I don't know about that. But my real question is, I want to ask you about the case of Cameron Todd Willingham. Mm. You know about this case?
Yeah, sure.
You know, and Texas is a state where, you know, executions have been occurring that have not been entirely kosher, where there's been, you know, exposure to corruption in the system there, and he's really been totally callous about it, and that's the thing that bothers me as a Christian. Mm. Because he's just been completely callous about what is pretty clearly the death of an innocent man.
No, I don't think it's at all clear the death.
I think you really need to
review the evidence in that case before you conclude that it was the death of an innocent man. I don't think it was any such thing. I have looked at it myself. It's been looked at by a dozen courts, and no one has ever, I think, concluded that this guy was an innocent man, even though there is substantial problems with some of the evidence. I mean, Texas has had things like this. Other states have had it as well. I can remember a case in Texas where there was a local county coroner who was a, you know, terrible drunk and a drug addict who essentially just faked coroner's reports in I don't know how many murder cases, dozens of them. What happened with that? Well, they had to reopen a bunch of cases. Did somebody get innocently executed? It's possible. I don't know. I haven't seen any evidence that actually happened, but it's certainly possible when you've got a coroner faking evidence. Human beings are fallible creatures. Human systems are fallible. If you're going to execute people and you're going to execute 10,000 people over the course of however many years, is it likely you're going to get someone who's not guilty? Well, yeah. I mean, human systems are imperfect. Well, if you're going to imprison people, you're going to imprison guilty people.
I'd like to see some concerns from the governor about that, and you haven't seen.
Well,
that.
No, I think that first of all, you don't understand how Texas works in terms of executions. The governor doesn't have any power on his own to pardon someone on death row. It would have to be recommended to him by the.
I'm not just talking about pardoning. I mean, the man's dead. He can't pardon him anymore. I'm talking about looking into
leadership. But certainly, before that would even happen, you have to have the Texas Parole and Pardons Board, which reviews the evidence on their own. So I don't think there's been
who
any.
Who appoints people to that board?
What's that?
Who appoints people to that board?
Oh, the governor does, of course. But, Perry's not the only governor in the history of Texas. There have been other people who have been on
that. No, he's not. He's
well.
Just the one who's in charge now.
Right. So, I don't think that there's any reason to conclude that Texas or Rick Perry or anyone else in the state has been negligent compared with other states in terms of reviewing its criminal justice procedures, in terms of looking at its protocols and things like that. I just don't think there's a lick of evidence on that.
I think folks might disagree.
Really? Well, let's hear it, Tim.
Well, look, I mean, if you look at the investigation conducted by David Graham of The New Yorker, that story was comprehensive. If you look at the conclusions by other investigations, by like the Innocence Project and other places, they've said, look, there are serious and systemic problems here, and Rick Perry has brushed those off.
So, a guy from The New Yorker says X, and every court that's looked at the case says Y.
Other people have said that, and it's not just a guy from The New Yorker. It's someone who's, you can be disparaging and make assumptions and just rely on prejudices. Oh, someone from New York can't go down to Texas and see
no,
what's
it's
going
not
on.
That it's someone that's been
facts,
from New York. It's that courts actually take the time to go over all the evidence in painstaking detail. The prosecution and the defense both get a chance to present everything they have, and every court that has looked at this concluded otherwise.
And you have a lot of... You have an awful lot of faith in government, as long as it's agreeing with you. If I were someone who was really concerned about what the state is doing and the imperfection of the government system and of man, that's the first place that I would be concerned about.
Well, in terms of my view of what it's proper and right for government to be doing, executing for people for murder is right at the top of the list. Until and unless I see a reason to think that there is some serious systemic error in the system, then I'm not too worried about it, honestly. And as a political matter, interesting thing, and you probably know this story, but maybe you don't. When Kay Bailey Hutchison was running against Perry, she had a little focus group, and she brought out basically all of her negative stuff, everything she could think of. And they made a big deal out of the Willingham case. And the focus group voters actually came out more strongly in favor of Perry than they had going in. Even though she repeatedly accused him of having executed an innocent man, as you are. So I'm not sure. Well, I think a couple of things are going on
I'm
there.
Not talking about this as a political matter.
Well, but it is a political matter. It is a political matter as well, because I think that you will find that in the general electorate, a lot of people are discounting your point of view because they think it's based basically in an ideology that is against capital punishment per se, whether it's applied to the innocent or the guilty. And I think you're going to have trouble making your case with them as you'll have trouble making it with me.
Well, again, I'm not making a political case on this one. This is a moral case.
Everything government does is a political
politics.
Case.
Sorry?
Everything government does is a political case.
I thought the whole Rick Perry thing was bringing morality and Christianity back into it. No? Let's talk about a straightforward political case. Let's talk about Wisconsin, where I believe today they are having recall elections for, I think, 6 Republican state senators and maybe 2 Democratic state senators in an effort by liberal groups to push back against the policies of the governor there, Scott Walker, who in a budget-cutting effort was going against labor unions, trying to get public sector labor unions decertified, to make it easier to cut their pay and cut their health benefits as part of belt-tightening efforts. There was obviously a big reaction. We all remember the protests in the State House. And now comes the political denouement as folks are trying to get some of the state senators changed around and change the results of the last election. Just from my point of view, what I think is interesting about this is to see progressive and liberal and Democratic activists doing something that's very useful. You know, you hear a lot of people complaining about, you know, Barack Obama is not doing what I want him to do. He's not giving the speech that I want him to do. He's not doing X. But you don't hear a lot of people coming up with solutions to that that aren't based on what Barack Obama should do. When, you know, the answer is, you know, progressives and Democrats need to convince more people in this country that they're right, and they need to elect more people at the state level and the congressional level before they even start blaming Barack Obama. And it's a path that was followed by a lot of folks on the right, a lot of conservatives, who in the 80s and 90s really focused on state legislatures and sort of built up their political class. So I think that's an interesting phenomenon and a useful one from the progressive point of view. It's going to be interesting. You know, you can't poll these kinds of elections very well because no one has a really good turnout model for an election that happens irregularly, and, you know, it's not during the real election season, so it's hard to tell who's checked in. It's hard to measure intensity and all of that, but it's going to be very interesting to see how all this shakes out. You know, the labor unions are promising a very strong reaction against Scott Walker's policies, and this will be the empirical test of that. What do you think, Kevin?
Yeah, well, you know, if you've ever tried to pull a tick out of yourself, you'll know they'll fight. And these public sector labor unions are parasites. They're largely unemployable in the private marketplace at the wages they're used to collecting in the political marketplace. And, yeah, I expect them to fight with every tool they have in the arsenal, you know, including terroristic threats, which have been a feature of life in Wisconsin recently. Who knew? But,
Terroristic threats.
Oh, yeah, the lady's being prosecuted for, you know, sending the letter to the legislatures. You and your families are all going to be killed for voting this way on this bill. A school teacher, she was. Kindergarten teacher, I think it was, actually. Charming. So, yeah, they're going to do everything they can to stop this. And I think the Republicans are probably going to get beat up in this election. I think out of the six who are up for recall, it looks like, you know, four at least have a very serious chance of losing their seats. You know, democracy in action, you get the government you deserve, I imagine. Although in the long term...
Well, what's interesting to me is that...
In the long term, of course, these wages are going down.
These parasites agreed to Scott Walker's demands. He said in the budget, you know, this is the budget I want, and I got to decertify these labor unions to get it. And they said, nah, we'll agree. And he said, no, I want to decertify you anyway. So I don't quite understand this parasites argument to the, you know, the people who... capture those criminals you're so fond of executing and put out the fires that arsonists may cause and who teach our children, you know, even if maybe one of them occasionally is, you know, off the loony bin. I wonder how many, you know, let's talk about our class. I hope I wouldn't be judged based on the bad actions of one journalist out there. So, you know, I think it's sort of inflammatory language and not super accurate. And I think it's interesting to see how the democratic process will work.
Well, certainly not parasites in the sense of collecting economic rents, you know, that they are collecting wages through the political process far in excess of what they would normally collect in a private competitive marketplace. I mean, this has been studied and studied and studied, and I think that the results of that have been pretty clear and consistent. So what you have is a group of people who are
show the public sector workers are underpaid.
What you're doing is you have
their private.
Well, then if you think so, if you think so,
that's also interesting to think.
Tim, if you believe that, there's a way to find out.
A lot of those teachers are paid more.
Tim, if you believe that, there's a way to find out whether they're underpaid or overpaid, which is to institute marketplace wages and find out which direction they go.
But I just don't think public education should be run through a private system.
Well, all right, but that's a separate question then.
Because
so
that's
if
a
you think
good
that they are
to everyone.
If you well it's not a public good actually under the classical economic definition of that term, it's not. But if you believe that they are underpaid, well, what does that mean? Underpaid compared to what? Compared with what they would make in the private marketplace? Or with some arbitrary standard that just came out of your head?
Oh, I mean, talking about public sectors overall being underpaid, if you look at studies that control for education and experience, consistently public sector workers are underpaid.
No, you know, I've looked at those studies, and they are mostly nonsense. For instance, the one that came out in Wisconsin, which actually covered several states, it treated everyone with a master's degree the same way. So if you have an MBA from Harvard or a master's in elementary education from University of East, wherever, it scored you exactly the same way. So these studies are not consistent. But again, if you think that they would earn more money in the private marketplace, that they are underpaid compared to what they're actually worth in the market, there's a good way to redress that. is a good way to find out what they're really worth in the marketplace. And the fact that they are fighting so hard to keep from finding out what they're actually worth in a real labor marketplace suggests that they know, as I know and as you know deep down inside, that they're grossly overcompensated for sitting around in offices.
Do you know what teachers do all day?
Yeah, I went to school.
Sit around in offices? You ever tried to teach a class of, you know, 30-some-odd fourth graders? It ain't sitting around in an office, buddy.
Mm.
It is not that.
I am a teacher, Tim. You know that, right?
You're a teacher?
I teach at King's College, yes.
You teach college students?
Yes.
Are you... Okay, well, that's a very different story, isn't it? A college professor who teaches... You know, how many classes do you teach a semester?
I teach one.
You teach one class.
Mm-hmm.
You teach one class. And how much grading do you do? Do you have TAs to do that?
No, I do my own grading.
And do you buy your own school supplies, or do the students provide them, or does the university provide them?
We don't have supplies in my class. We just have brains.
Okay, so that's probably not a 12-hour day that starts at 7 a.m. and goes to 7 p.m. where someone's dealing with children for almost the entire period of that. And it's not a time when they're...
Are you making an economic argument or an appeal to sympathy?
I'm just saying, I don't know if your personal experience is really relevant to the question.
Well, what I know is this, that if you look at wage scales on a per-hour basis for public school educators versus most other jobs, you will find them enormously overcompensated. Now, I'll be happy to send you the studies if you want to look at them. Particularly administrative salaries. You know, I mean, I'm from Lubbock, Texas, a little town in the middle of nowhere. Why are we paying public school administrators $250,000 a year? I mean, that's just insane. If you look at the actual compensation structures versus almost any other sort of business, you'll find that they're irrational and grotesquely swollen. And that's our hour.
I mean, I don't know the specific situation in Lubbock, Texas.
Well, look at New York, look at Philadelphia, look at Washington, D.C., look at Chicago.
And, you know, a couple thousand children under their supervision, you know, maybe we should hire someone who's pretty competent and compensate them accordingly.
Well, there's competent and there's compensation, and you're begging the question that you think the two are related in the way that the people in the schools are saying that they're related. And, again, this is a fairly easy thing to figure out. Give them market wages and see what the market does. Otherwise, you're just distorting, and we know which way you're distorting.
That's not the answer. I mean, that is not the answer for public education.
Of course it is.
The answer to determine if there's, you know, wage crash is not to privatize public education.
Well, that's the only way you're going to find out what the actual market value of their wages is have a market. Otherwise, you're just imposing an arbitrary political standard, which is what you do when you try to impose planning on an economy.
Well, I prefer my education public. And, you know, I think, frankly, that teachers have shown willingness, teachers unions across the country, to talk about how to improve this. I mean, look, I don't love teachers unions, everything they do. I think that there's a lot of changes that need to be made. I liked in D.C. a lot of what Michelle Rhee was doing there. You know, there are real problems here. But I think the answer is not to go against public sector unions, and the answer is not to privatize the public school system. The answer is to get people around a table and make it work and figure out, you know, real solutions to this. And you see people across the country moving towards
when
it.
When I hear the words get people around the table and figure out real solutions, I know that everyone's out of ideas. But I'll leave you with this because our hour is up. There's a reason why your cell phone gets better and cheaper every year and your schools get more expensive and more dysfunctional. And once you figure that out, you'll know why they ought to be privatized.
Yeah, my cell phone is really crappy. It's getting worse every year. I miss the old flip phones. The smartphones do not do phone calls very well, iPhones in particular.
All right, talk to you next time.
Take it easy, Kevin.